Lowe's knows you want the best for dad. This Father's Day, help him take on any project with big deals on DeWalt. Right now, get a free XR 8 amp hour battery when you buy select DeWalt tools. That's not all. Get up to two free select tools when you buy a select DeWalt 20 volt max battery kit. Maximum initial battery voltage measured without a work load is 20 volts. Nominal voltage is 18.
What do you hear from, you've done tons of these workshops.
Well, one thing I notice is that as we iterate, teams inevitably get faster and faster and faster. It's as if there's a mind meld going on, right? There's no pause, hardly any pause at all. You get really good at that, get really good at picking up on each other's cues, and you become synchronous.
And that's exactly right. As you try three things or a lot of these other drills, it helps you get out of your head a little bit. And that's part of the beauty of it, that sort of anxiety and hesitation that you may feel when you first start doing any sort of improv game, three things or others, it starts to go away. And we found that ability to get out of your head translates into a lot of success in a lot of different areas of life, frankly.
Why did I become an executive coach? I saw lots of great people fail to get ahead at work, while their much less talented peers blew right past them. That made me furious, but also curious. What were great people getting wrong? It came down to helping them re-examine what drove success and then helping them make critical shifts, one hard truth at a time.
Feel like you're doing everything you were told, but you're not moving ahead at work nor having the impact you seek? Then welcome to 97% Effective with Michael Winderoth, where we skip feel-good, happy talk and engage experts in pointed conversations about what it really takes to move the needle at work and your career. So if you feel stalled or frustrated or seek that extra edge as you move to the next level, then look no further. This is the Hard Truths Playbook you never got.
Hi, I'm Michael Winderoth, and you're listening to 97% Effective. Improvisation is not just in comedy clubs or team building. It's showing up in boardrooms, innovation processes at companies, and high-stakes conversations at work. But does improv actually work? And more to the point, what we're going to discuss today is how can you make it work for you in your work. Today, I'm excited. I am speaking with Cassini Yip and Kevin Weinstein, co-authors of, let me pull it up here, Yes And or Success. They argue that principles of improv, and this took me back many years, listening deeply, building on other people's ideas, being comfortable with ambiguity, is not only fun, I know that scares people who think about that, but are powerful tools and skills that can supercharge your ability to communicate, build connection, and increase creativity. Cassini Angostieri Yip is a communication strategist, having spent two decades managing reputations and shaping stories with agencies, in-house, and as a consultant. Kevin Weinstein is an expert in systems engineering, with more than 20 years applying that expertise across industries as a consultant. Both of them are trained improvisers, interesting path of how they came to it. And together, teaming up at executive education when they met at Stanford University's LEAD program, founded Creative Catalyst, whose mission is to banish the boring in corporate cultures and ignite creativity and collaboration using the unexpected power of improv. Cassini and Kevin, thank you for joining me on 97% Effective. I'm excited today.
Thanks so much for having us.
So are we. Thanks for having us.
You guys are totally in sync. I can tell you've worked together. And I want to start just a short introduction there, but I want to flip this around and start our episode today with you guys leading with a short, your book is full of practical improv exercises. We are doing this remotely. We're not in the room, but maybe just a short one between the three of us that would get us going and warmed up to enter this episode.
Absolutely. Kevin, we said we wanted to do maybe three things.
I think three things will be perfect.
All right. Michael, you may already know this, but for the sake of our audience members and our listeners today, three things is a very cool game that is good for two people or more or a bunch. And in this game, the idea is to name a category and have folks go around in a circle and answer as quickly as possible. The goal here is not perfection. It's to get the answers out and keep going as a team and see how fast you can go. So with that, we're going to start. Physicality is also really important, how you hold yourself and what you do with your hands. So in this case, we're going to start with, can everyone hold up their fists like this next to their chins? And we're going to pump our fists three times as we yell, one time as we yell three things. Ready? Three, two, one. Three things.
Three things.
Great. All right, Kevin, please name three cereals that you would not like to try first thing in the morning.
Garlic oat bran, squid flavored oatmeal, and cranberry crunch.
All right.
Three things.
Great. And you pass it on to Michael.
Michael, what are three books you would never consider reading?
Three books that I would never consider reading. Different ways to pick up your dog's poop. Foods that we should never eat. And my trip staying home.
Three things. Would you like to pass one on to me and then that'll be the end of this round?
Okay. So three things. I'm passing it on to Cassini. Like to hear three things that we can't find about you on the internet.
Ooh, wow. What color socks I have on today. Where I lived in Chiang Rai, Thailand in 1989 and what I was doing. And lastly, what I like to do when I go to a beach near my house here in San Francisco with my dog. Three things. All right. So as you can see, it's a fun game. It's not at all about perfection or a right answer. It is also not something that requires a whole lot of preparation, nor should it require preparation. It's actually something that requires us to be in the moment, be ready to go, and think on our feet. So what would you add, Kevin?
Something I love about three things is it works for in Zoom or in room improvising, which is a term I think we coined recently, where you can do this anywhere. You can do this in a car. You can do this with your kids. And it's, again, low preparation and doesn't require a ton of skill, which is why it's also perfect for groups who may not be as familiar with improv or as comfortable trying it. So it gives people a chance to dip their toe in the water and be a little creative. Sometimes that game gets a little silly. And again, if you use that before a meeting, you'll find that people may be a bit more creative and honest with each other.
Also,
and I want to ask you both, because I certainly felt... I know, Kevin, this is Cassini, it's the first time we've met, and we will be broadcasting this out. I felt a certain anxiety come up. You know, I was on the spot, and I'm like, am I supposed to do this fast? What if my answer sounds really dumb? But kind of pushing through it, and then everyone kind of going through it, I think that helped kind of let that go away. Is that a kind of normal reaction? And when you're doing this, because you've done it a lot, what do people tell you that they kind of get out of it? I know you guys have shared what you sense, but what do you hear from, you've done tons of these workshops.
Well, one thing I notice is that as we iterate, teams inevitably get faster and faster and faster. And if you go to a professional ensemble, you'll be amazed at how quickly, blazingly fast, these groups go through these exercises. It's as if there's a mind meld going on, right? There's no pause, hardly any pause at all. You get really good at that, get really good at picking up on each other's cues, and you become synchronous. So we talk a little bit more about synchronicity in our book. We can get to that later. The other thing I noticed that people comment on is how much easier it gets with each iteration. And lastly, how much fun it is and how that fun kind of overtakes and eventually replaces the anxiety part of it. And this is true across cultures. We've done this in different places, across different types of groups, people with different backgrounds, training, homes, you know, all different cultures.
And that's exactly right. As you try three things or a lot of these other drills, it helps you get out of your head a little bit. And that's part of the beauty of it, that sort of anxiety and hesitation that you may feel when you first start doing any sort of improv game, three things or others, it starts to go away. And we found that that ability to get out of your head translates into a lot of success in a lot of different areas of life, frankly.
The last thing I'll say is the laughter. I have yet to do a three things game where there was zero laughter. So we like to say laughter is kind of guaranteed.
It did. There was the laughter, I think, because it was a little bit silly. But also, I felt with both of you, and maybe particularly with Cassini, because I don't know you at all. I just came up with that question on the fly. But all of a sudden, I'm like curious about like, what did you do that year in Thailand?
Right.
Well, that's also part of how I saw improv as a means to connect with others, because oftentimes I would go to an improv class, especially if it's my first time improvising with a given group, and I don't know anyone in that room, and I don't know their backgrounds, and we start with improv games, warm-ups, just like that one, and by the end, we'll often, you know, go out together for a meal or something, and we have something to talk about. Wasn't that really funny when, or you often will know people for weeks or months before you have any idea of what they do outside of improv.
And in that spirit, I'm wondering, because there was this anxiety I had the first time, could we just do it again really quickly? Because you talked about iterations and what happens. I just want to see what it feels like a second iteration. Can we do that?
Yes, and.
Well, yes, and. Let's go. Who goes first?
Michael, what's an animal you would love to have as a pet?
A Spanish Mastin. Cassini, what is a Thai food that you would love for us to both try?
Oh my goodness, it has to be durian. Durian. It's the food that loves to be hated. And anyway, we're supposed to go around. So we've made this one thing, so which is fine. Kevin.
No mistakes in improv. We'll try it.
What's one thing that you would like to not find between your big toe and middle toe, second toe.
An elephant.
So in the iteration, I did feel like we have kind of, and perhaps because you've kind of given permission for this to be fun, we're just having fun with it. We just kind of went with the flow, or I'm feeling that. I want to ask a question of like, okay, so this feels fun, silly. We're getting to know each other. These points you brought up around connection. It does feel like maybe in certain corporate environments, you could take this in and, you know, there would be some stress if people aren't set up for this exercise, right? Like, this is stupid. And, you know, people are very stiff. How do you kind of make it work in a corporate environment?
We actually had a client that was setting up a U.S. Office. They had a particular culture. This was an Asian-based company. And what they did was they had their executives run a round of three things before then having everyone else participate. And I thought that was wonderful and genius because it set the tone. It also gave permission for everyone else to also be silly. And I think by doing that, that helped alleviate a lot of anxiety. So I do think that understanding the culture or the challenge that you're stepping into is a key part of what we spend a lot of time on before we engage with clients. We're not just in there to go and say, okay, let's just have a great time and then we'll see you later. It's really, I think Kevin and I bring, with our years of experience in business, we bring this deep understanding of a lot of different areas that maybe a theater troupe might not offer, right? When you come in and just do a quick team building and then say bye-bye. Anything else, Kevin?
I would add that it shouldn't be mandatory. If someone feels completely uncomfortable, has crippling stage fright, the last thing I want to do is put them up in front of their boss or their boss's boss or a team of their peers to try something that'll make them uncomfortable. It's not a good fit for them, and it's not a good fit for the team. It's just going to probably make things worse. So I would also make the point that, like with any connection, Carol Robin goes into making yourself, you know, trying 15%. And if they feel like they can try a three things and they only give one and they kind of disengage after that, just be a little bit, do a little bit to connect and back off when it feels uncomfortable. And as teams attempt these games and try what we're doing here, they tend to feel more comfortable with it. And Cassini's point, let the senior leaders try it first. And then, hey, does anybody feel comfortable? Does anyone want to try it? And as a general rule, we found everybody wants to participate on some level. And the important thing as a facilitator is to make sure that it's a level where they feel comfortable and they get the desired results from it.
So it sounds like making this work, right, isn't, I think some people have this notion, right, that you just kind of get there and then you're just in the moment doing weird stuff. There is some level of planning, right? I think, Cassini, you certainly brought this up, but thinking about how you structure this, set it up, maybe do it so that it fits into that culture or people are set up to get the benefits of being in the moment, right? In a kind of space that works. Is that a fair characterization of that, or would you add anything?
I think that's absolutely fair. And each game or exercise doesn't do the same thing, right? Different exercises focus on different skills. Some may focus more on listening more intently. There are other exercises that involve no talking, no verbalization whatsoever. This game called Mirror Mirror, which is really focused on visualization and literally physically mirroring the other person. There are other games that talk about, and some of this is talked about in the book Impro by the great Keith Johnstone here, status. You practice status. So what does it feel like to be high status, low status? There are other games that involve practicing being large, being small, going fast, going slow. So all these different dynamics that come from theater that the executive and business person can use in their toolkit. It's also really helpful in personal life too. How do I sound, at home? How do I look?
How do I make sure my intended message is what I, how do I make sure that my intended message is received as intended?
Absolutely.
So there's a large toolkit of exercises that may hone different muscles and work. It is a question kind of before we started that we started talking about. Yep. We're here doing this virtually on Zoom. There was a little bit of lag. I feel like I'm looking at one part, maybe talking to another, even after all these years being on Zoom. Could you talk about this? We started to have an interesting conversation about when you're doing improv and how to make it work live versus remote. And I understand too that you guys also came into improv in different settings, learning it in different ways, in different mediums to start. So this, I think, Kevin, you were saying it's Zoom versus room. Please talk about this dynamic.
Sure. My intro to improv was literally a class near my house where it was sort of a tech detox every week where I would go for a few hours and, you know, I wouldn't have my phone. I would just be there in the moment and playing games with all these very funny or sometimes very serious people, depending on the drill. And I went through the intro class repeatedly because it was fun. And sometimes it was the only class they offered because it was nearby. It was a new school. So sometimes we would go all the way through and we'd have people who would stick from intro all the way through advanced classes. And then other times we would just keep running the intro class. And after several times taking the intro class, they asked me to help teach it. So that was fun. And bottom line, I was there as part of a tech detox because I consciously knew I needed to get away from my phone, away from my computer, and just focus on something that was fun and enjoyable. And then COVID happened, and this outlet turned into spending more time at my computer with every bell and whistle going off on my computer, and I was just so distracted. I had to take a break from improv as part of, you know, adjusting to life during the pandemic, and that was a huge adjustment for me. And then Cassini, I was so happy to meet her because she helped me better understand how to go from in-room to in-Zoom improv, and I'll turn to her to share those insights.
Yeah, thanks, Kevin. So while I started and dabbled in improv years ago, I really didn't jump in a very deep way until COVID. You know, we all were feeling super isolated, alone, and quite frankly, horrible. And I decided one day to see what was out there. I found a little application I did years ago in college to be a resident assistant. And the line on the last page said, "What do we need to know about you?" And I said, "One day I'd like to try improv." I said, "Well, gosh, I don't want to wait another couple decades to try this." So that moment I went and logged on and found what I could find and signed up for the first class. And it was a Zoom-based class because that's all we were able to do in the depths of the pandemic. And that's how I really honed my craft. Every day that was on Zoom, that was an improv class, seemed to be a better and brighter day for me anyway. The opportunity to connect with others through these squares or rectangles that we're looking at felt to me like a lifeline. It really did. All the laughter, all the joy, all the silliness, all the connection and the opportunity to keep learning together with a group of people was exactly what I needed. And then when I met Kevin at Stanford as part of the executive education program and found someone who was equally passionate about improv, I thought, oh my gosh, this is great. And that's when we started riffing off of each other, quite honestly.
Yeah, you guys do a lot of riffing. And I'll put you on the spot here, right? Because the show is about kind of giving people practical tips. So if someone is wanting to do improv, obviously picking up your book and then just starting to do it, some of these exercises, you know, you can click on the QR codes and see those. But to this specific point, if they're doing it virtually or they're doing it in person, maybe like one tip to think about that would make it more effective in either medium.
Ooh, that's a good question, because they are very, very different mediums. And there was a transition going from one to the other. With Zoom, I think being aware of what the limitations of the medium are is super important. For example, you can't see what's going on in, you know, from here downward, right? So if we need to stand and be using our arms and legs, have to back up and make an effort and give these directions. One of the most surprising things I found in running Zoom workshops is how many times I have to remind people, not only at the outset, to keep the cameras on, right? There's something about different cultures of different organizations, right? Because there's so much Zoom fatigue, how do you do a Zoom workshop in improv and not have the camera on? That's a challenge. So we talk about this and we ask people who want to participate to please have the camera on, because you convey, and I think one of your other guests mentioned this too, but the majority of what you convey when you communicate is visual, followed by what? Verbal and physical. Followed by verbal, sorry. So that's why we say it's super important to keep that on. Now, physical, you have all this stuff about blocking and where you are on stage and projection. Not that you don't have that on Zoom, but it's much more exaggerated when you're in a large auditorium.
And the point I would add is there are some drills that really lend themselves to in Zoom improv versus in room, where you have a lot more flexibility and a lot more freedom to try more physical. And physicality is a key part of improv. And in fact, of the three ways to start a scene, one of them is a physical activity. So it is a major part of it. However, what working with Cassini showed me is there are some drills that work really well on Zoom also. And knowing which is which we decided was important to put in the book as well, to, you know, you're not going to have as much fun with a sound and motion drill as you will with a three things or a word at a time story or something like that. So making sure that your drill matches your medium, matches your audience is hugely important.
Yeah, again, so that idea of being very deliberate and thinking about how you do that to at least set it up.
You've been listening to 97% Effective with your host, executive coach Michael Winderoth. If this interview is making you think, make sure to share it with a friend. Now, back to our interview.
So I want to go a little deeper here in our conversation on the different aspects, right, that you talk about how improv can help with our communication, connection, and creativity. We've touched on these elements. But maybe to start, I want to start with communication, because this is where, as an executive coach, I actually will recommend to a lot of my clients who rehearsed preparation, they feel quite confident, but it's in that kind of in the moment when I'm being grilled, especially in a high stakes situation, they get very uncomfortable. Then their communication reflects that, which then doesn't come across as effective, or they don't seem as competent or confident. So just to look through the example you brought up, Kevin, and it's one of the examples you brought in this book. First of all, I was like, you took seven of the courses, and you said on each iteration, it stuck out to me that you felt your communication getting better. Now, you're an engineer by background, and you talked a little bit about that. Could you share with us, you know, where it was most helpful, how your communication, particularly in impromptu situations, got better? I think this is a really kind of the heart of improv, and I'd like to hear how you went through that, and maybe Cassini can point out some stuff as the communications expert as well.
Happy to. I was absolutely shocked at where I saw improvement and what improvement I saw. First of all, it made me much better at empathy and understanding my audience, because I previously hadn't really thought as much about the person I'm speaking to as the important part of communication. I was so focused on my message. I need to make sure they know this. I need to make sure they know this. When if I'm being a good steward of that person's time and energy, I need to think, what do they need to know from me? What do they need from me in this moment? And improv helped me better understand audiences and collaborating with others. Because in an improv scene, everyone's equal in an improv school. You go there, everyone has the same status. Everyone has something to contribute. And whatever someone brings into a scene is valid, it's true, and you run with it. And that was a fun departure for me. I never was in a situation where my viewpoints had as much credibility as the highest status person in the room. And at the same time, everyone in the room had the same level of seniority that I did. So that was a lot of fun. And also, something that I did not expect was my information recall improved dramatically. If every week you're going to an improv school, you don't know if it's going to be an alien invasion, if you're going to be working in a cafeteria that suddenly got slammed with people, or there's a rowdy guest in a in a party. You just don't know. And all of those things, you're not prepared for it, even though improv has a structured form. It's really all about the emergent behavior that comes out of it. So it made me better able to recall facts and knowledge that I would need to do my job, even though Lord knows I wasn't in improv school thinking, how can I do a better job of remembering last month's numbers? So not having to be creative made me, in non-creative places, it helped me recall information, and because being creative does require a little bit more horsepower sometimes.
When I think about traditional corporate communications or executive communications or the kind of communications that founders of startups might be thinking about, the whole idea of knowing your audience and personas is super important. And in the science and the practice of communications, I always like to start with know your audience. Now, when you're in an improv class or workshop, you don't always know your audience in the way you think, right? As Kevin mentioned, you might be in a group with the senior executives, with the engineers, with the folks from accounting, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But do you really know who they are? and you may not. And that's as he put it, that's what makes improv a great equalizer. In fact, in the schools systems in Japan, improv is utilized in the schools to help those who are shyer come out of their shells, especially in international schools when you have a lot of different cultures. And they have found that it's been a very effective tool for helping the kids begin to work together more collaboratively and with more ease. And so that's one thing that improv has really helped with. It helps with that ease and that ability to collaborate. The other thing I want to mention is classically, when you think about effective communications, it's helpful to think about what you want people to know, think, feel, and do. So know slash think, feel, and do. Well, in order to do that, what do you need to do? You need to be able to empathize, and improv helps us empathize with others because you have to simultaneously be taking in information from the other party and then be prepared to yes and or support what they're doing or saying. This, if we haven't talked about the principle of yes anding yet, maybe this is a good time to just mention quickly. A lot of what underpins improv games is the idea of yes and that is the philosophy, I'm going to call it philosophy, that you're there to support one another and make each other look good. You don't use the word but because it's a blocker. And we do an exercise that's called yes and versus yes but to demonstrate the expansive power of a yes and frame of mind versus a yes, but, right? And it's pretty eye-opening for people to see the difference between yes and yes, but. Hopefully that answers a little bit of what we were trying to get at and some of my observations about the connection between influence.
Yeah, I think of it as that kind of very generative, this whole yes and that you were just describing. I want to ask, though, that the yes and, the generative aspect, can that stifle in some way pushback, which you also kind of want to see, you know, bringing up different points of view or potentially it can, I would see it as potentially also leading to groupthink, mm-hmm. right? Where everyone wants us to kind of build on this instead of critiquing. Mm-hmm. How do you think about that in terms of that balance? Or is that the wrong way to be thinking about where it could lead to?
I don't think it's the wrong way to think of it. I'll yes and the idea. Yeah. Because you'll also find that sometimes if you're looking at the default state of a team, people are usually very quick to disagree, maybe even with incomplete information. So the idea here isn't to always use improv. Treat it like a tool, like, and it happens to be a power tool in this case, but treat it like a tool. I used the word but. Treat improv like a tool. And there are times where it helps teams be more creative, more collaborative. And then there are times where, you know, maybe saying yes to something that's illegal, immoral, or just plain wrong is not the right answer, and you need to put a stop to it. So, in fact, I would even argue that in improv, usually there's each class or each workshop will have a code where if someone says it, cuts off the scene, and we can either talk about it or not if someone feels uncomfortable. And that principle sort of applies here,
too. It's about having a safe space. You're building safe spaces. That's how I look at different exercises and games when you get into a room with a group of people and start doing these games. Create safe spaces and make people comfortable. And that's where people can flourish and give generously in their ideas and thinking. And hopefully we get the best work and the best outcomes.
Yeah, and that leads us to, right, stronger connection and creative, kind of more expansive thinking out of the box mm-hmm. often. Cassini, I want to ask you the same thing about, you know, you were a communications consultant, an expert across a lot of different areas mm-hmm. for a long time. Then you kind of used improv. And so for you, how did the integration of improv impact your work, right? You were consulting and teaching others mm-hmm. around communication, reputation building, et cetera. Mm-hmm. How did that supplement or shift how you thought about communications?
And I can continue to consult, and I will say that it dovetailed very, very nicely. As a matter of fact, I was consulting for large tech company. And when they found out that improv was something that I did, I was invited to do a couple of exercises for different groups and teams, varying sizes. And the teams found that it was very, very helpful in terms of gelling, in terms of having a good break, getting a little more active. You know, we are in our chairs, many of us, for throughout the day if we're working remotely. And it meshes nicely with the idea of, you know Carol Dweck, I know you do, of a growth mindset, which many teams and organizations are after now. The idea that there's this brain plasticity, if you've got a construct that you can always continue to learn and grow, then you're going to be more receptive, right, to different opportunities and ideas. And what a great way to practice that with improv exercises. So in my case, I think it was just, again, adding additional tools to supplement a foundation that was already there. We already knew about strategy. We already know about the theory of how to put strategy and tactics together to achieve and support business outcomes. And how do we help and bring along all members of our team, through various environments and situations. That's really where improv has made a profound connection for me.
And Kevin, I mean, we talked about how when you took the classes, your communication improved. You also lead lots of teams. How did you find other ways that you were integrating it and using it at work?
I'd say one way I found myself integrating at work, it made me much better at collaborating with people who are vastly different from myself. Prior to improv and maybe, you know, just earlier in my educational background, I spent a lot of time around engineers. And when you have an insular community, I would say it's probably a little bit less important what that community is, but you have that insular community, certain things garner more respect or less respect, and there are certain norms that come out of it. And going through improv classes and improv training, it made me much better at collaborating with people who are different from me and may have backgrounds I'm less familiar with, because every week I was doing it. And practice makes you better at almost anything that's worth doing. And for me, improv helped me just be a better collaborator. And there are certain principles within improv that also just started showing up in my day-to-day, like making other people look good and being helpful and finding, when I disagreed with people, finding polite ways to do it. And sometimes you can even use yes and to show the problem with an idea someone brings, and then they find a good solution and you come out of it, wow, their idea was really good because I hadn't thought how to work around this small, minute problem I had with what they were bringing to the table. And I'd say, if anything, it opened my aperture to the fact that there are a lot of skill sets I don't have that I can now work with effectively and, you know, frankly, value more. And hopefully it's also resulted in people valuing my skill set more.
It's super interesting. And I just want to ask too, because you playing the guitar came up several times in the book. It sounds like you have played for a long time. And did improv at all shape or change how you went about playing or practicing the guitar? It sounds like you also have a lot of dedication to that craft. I'm curious how improv played with that craft.
I love that question. I would say that it made me more willing to go out and perform. Yeah. And what improv also helped me with was, I wouldn't say I had a huge amount of stage fright, but there was a certain level of what if I mess up that would kind of go through my head sometimes in situations like performing and playing my guitar in public. And what improv helped me do was realize that the audience is supportive. They want you to succeed. And if you mess up, it's kind of okay. And you had a speaker recently or a guest on your show who talked about how once you're established as competent, mistakes just make you more authentic. And that sort of mindset also permeates into improv, where mistakes are okay. Everyone makes them. And in fact, we have some drills where you intentionally make mistakes and everybody cheers. The idea is it helps show that you have that support, and improv helped me get over the fact that, yeah, I can play guitar in public. Maybe I'm not good enough to get paid for it, but someday, growth mindset to our earlier discussion. And it helped help me understand that audiences are there to support you, and there's really no reason to be afraid of mistakes. So from that standpoint, improv really did help my music practice as well.
the examples that you guys are talking about, and I can also see it in your body language as you talk about how it's been used in your teams, helped yourself. You know, the teaching workshop consultants in each of you, how do you build this into the culture of a company? I know this, it kind of feels like a large meta question, but you know, there's so many places that are toxic, that are rigid, engagement is low, a lot of politics, really one of the topics of this podcast. And so how do you kind of get that wedge in there where this starts to kind of grow and become part of the culture? If you're thinking about how to implement it, how would you go about, or you recommend other people go about doing it?
I have a thought about that. My thought is start.
I do too, but I want to hear your thoughts.
Please, yeah, please share.
Yeah.
Let's.
Yeah, my thought is start small. Start where you can. As I consider all the different places I've worked and throughout my career, and look at where I was able to have the most impact, surprisingly, these were places, these included places that were traditionally bureaucratic, large, monolithic, you know, local government, you know, large integrated healthcare system. And I think that's because in those situations, I started with smaller teams, which eventually then grew. And I went in with a let's try this, let's pilot that mindset. Right? Let's throw spaghetti against the wall and see what sticks, right? Let's see what happens. And it was really working, first of all, listening very intently to what people's needs were, but also then working one-on-one to understand what their needs were, and then doing the slow and important work of putting together how to meet people where they are. And we talk about meeting people where they are in our book as well, and how that's an important skill. And so one by one by one, I was able to bring forth things like modernizing a public record system, you know, by working with people one-on-one. It was a slow process. So I think that's how I would approach it. You look at the opportunities and opportunity to have little skunk works within a larger organization and do your entrepreneurship. In another case, the organization didn't have, was concerned about not having enough publicity. And the one question I asked among this leadership team was, well, how much advertising money have you devoted? And you could hear a pin drop in this meeting and went, aha, that's something we can work with here. And from there, went one by one by one, finding the right people, and was able to get that organization their very first ever press conference in DC that garnered some great national attention and attention in the industry. So my answer goes back to one step at a time, put one foot in front of another. Mm-hmm. We talk about that too. One foot in front of another, one step at a time.
Yeah, what's funny to me about the question, and there's no way you knew this before the podcast, Michael, my final project for Huggy Rouse Change Leadership class was how to bring improv training into an engineering organization. Mm-hmm. And my answer is going to be sort of aligned to that, where you have to treat it like an organizational change. There are going to be stakeholders who have a variety of viewpoints on even something simple like improv training, or simple yet hugely impactful. You'll have people who are really excited about it and really want to sponsor it and make sure it works. And you'll also have people who are probably invested in seeing it fail. If you're a senior engineering leader or senior person at a company where now improv is something that you are being judged on, it's now a threat. So recognizing that improv training or bringing improv skills into a culture is an organizational change, much like a new ERP system or a corporate merger, and using the same type of methodology around persuasion, recruiting, energizing, because frankly, no change happens without some energy behind it. People are either angry and afraid or really supportive to make a change. And then making sure that you have the correct staffing and sequencing behind your activities. And again, to Cassini's point, the ability to experiment with it in a low-risk way to shape beliefs and behaviors in reverse order is super important as well. So treating improv and that culture change as the large scale organizational change that it might actually be is important, rather than, oh, we're going to try improv today. Now it's part of the culture. And since I'm the CEO, everybody's going to listen to me. The same predictable failures will happen as with any type of organizational change you try to implement that way.
Yeah, really practical ways of thinking about this. I love it. To shift gears, and as we're getting closer to the end of our time here, so the book, you know, at the time of recording this, it was fairly recently in the last, you know, first quarter of this year that you launched the book. And I always like to ask authors, as you've put it out there, what interesting things have kind of come out of that as you put that into the world, either surprising? I just love to hear what the reaction's been or what you found most interesting from putting that out there into the world.
Kevin and I, we just talked about this the other day, and I think that we were overwhelmed by the support, you know, that we received early on, a couple of days after putting it out there. Our books sold out at the bookstore, and the continued support we get day to day. And what else did we say, Kevin? I'm sorry, it's early still.
Well, we should also be improvising. There's no reason to remember what we said. We can say something new. We've been, to Cassini's point, yes, and we've been overwhelmed by the support, but also been really excited about people telling us, hey, I've used improv, I've tried the games, I've clicked the QR codes and found ways to use this in my organization. And to me, that's the rewarding thing. I didn't, and Cassini can speak differently if she disagrees, but my goal with this book was not to, you know, become a billionaire. It was to spread a message and build a reputation. And I've been really happy to see how this message has been embraced by so many different people in so many geographies. And it's been really great to put something out into the world and give value to other people's lives who decide to consume it.
Yeah. And I think like there should be another QR code where people like upload their little stories or success, because it's always interesting to, you know, see those examples of how it's been put in practice, the little tips, the community that builds around things. And I think you've, you know, in that spirit of kind of connection, you know, and collaboration, I think this lends itself very much to that. So I you've shared some of those stories already. But I think there's even more there. So I'm excited about that.
Second edition will have that. I love that idea. Yes, and Michael.
And I also want to yes, give credit to someone, and that is Matt Abrahams, with whom, you know, lecturer at Stanford on communications and, you know, podcast is Think Fast, Talk Smart. And it was through some conversations that Kevin and I had with him that, this QR code idea was thrown about and then got put into the book. So I'm really excited and continuing to hear what people think about the QR codes. We know that people learn in different ways, right? Visual learning versus, you know, straight reading. And we hope that that's a useful mode that people can use to learn and to really capture what we're trying to convey in terms of exercises.
And that's actually a fun callback to your point, Michael, about change. So every chapter we have these exercises so people can experiment. They can form their own opinion. Maybe one of these exercises that Cassini and I find super useful is something they're not comfortable doing yet. And that's okay. That's fine. Hopefully in the dozens of different exercises we've given them, they find something that works for them, for their team, for their context. So,
and on that invitation, I want to end with an improv exercise, or have you guys end us with an improv exercise. But before we go there, is there any question I didn't ask that I should have here that you want people to know? So you can go ahead and answer it too.
I've got one. Improv has a reputation for being highly humorous. How do we bring it into a corporate environment where there may be varying levels of humor that are acceptable or desirable.
And how do you do that, Kevin?
And I would first, there was a book that really helped me better understand humor in the workplace, and that's Humor Seriously by Jennifer Ocker and Naomi Bagdonis. And it talks about how the barrier, people will always appreciate, or according to their research, almost always appreciate attempts at humor, even if they fail, provided you haven't offended someone. And back to your earlier question about performing in public and such, the act of trying is still a way to build a connection. And tailoring for audience, because if you're in an HBO special, the type of humor that gets by at work will probably not get you many laughs. And if you try to bring the level of energy and excitement and enthusiasm of a comedy show to a 8 a.m. meeting on a Friday morning, that's probably going to fall flat too. So it provides a lot of good rules and, well, rules of thumb for how much humor, how much energy, how to make sure you're matching the room and being cognizant of power dynamics when you are bringing humor into the workplace. And again, those power dynamics are also important to think about when you're using improv at work.
Yeah, great book. I'll put a link in the show notes. Mm-hmm. Cassini, any final question I didn't ask that we should have explored more?
I didn't have one. I didn't have another question that we should have explored more. I think that's great.
So then I'll use that as the invitation to end us with an improv exercise here, or maybe that gets us started, so to speak.
All right, Kevin.
So we'd like to try, and Michael, provided you're comfortable joining us for this improv exercise, we'd like to try word-at-a-time stories. And in a word-at-a-time story, you only get one word to advance the story. And I'll start by saying, same rules as three things, where if your word makes the story not that good, the point here is not to win a Pulitzer. The point here is to get out of your head, to throw something, throw out an idea, and just have a little fun. So we'll try a one-word story. And since this is a Zoom, in Zoom versus in room, let's establish order. So we can go me, then Cassini, then Michael. And then that continues until we decide we are done with our story. So
I love it. I'm in.
Go. Okay. Perfect. So we'll get started. Once.
That's what we like to hear. Upon.
A.
Time.
There.
Was.
A.
Martian.
In.
The.
Cafe.
Olé.
Eating.
A.
Interesting.
Kind.
Of.
Meat.
Which.
Painstakingly.
And.
Disturbingly.
Was.
Very.
Odoriferous.
Chef.
And.
Server.
Decided.
That.
The.
Meal.
Was.
On the free.
Customers.
Began.
Fuming.
About.
The.
Freebie.
However,
they
decided
to
throw
a
party.
Big time.
That's a great place to end. That's such a fun story.
it took us to interesting places. And just to reflect on that, you really had to pay attention, or I felt, and I feel like I've done this exercise, but I haven't done it in a long time. what others were saying, right? The kind of lead or the follow, and then to kind of build on that. So that's where I, you know, enjoyed really paying attention.
And what's fun about that game to me is that you're building something with a team. You have input, but you don't have full control over it. None of us had any idea where that story was going to go. We just knew where it had been and where, with that one word, we'd like to take it next. And it's fun. And I've found that in conversations like that, you end up connecting with people over the fact that you just wrote this really silly story about a Martian in a cafe.
And a great party, too, right? I love playing. I love, you know, this is why they call improv play. And I know with other guests, you've talked about the role of joy and fun in play. And I can't think of, you know, I can think of few activities that are as fun that you can do with one other person or do in big groups that allow you to connect, to be active, to take notice of other people, to keep learning and to give and to be generous of your spirit, you know, with your spirit. And that's quite frankly what hooked me. and that's, yeah.
As a kid, they get recess. And for me, improv is the closest thing I've found to recess for my brain.
Yeah.
And just the, we talked about the connection, but that we did go through that. And I mean, this is very memorable too, right? We'll come back and say, hey, we played that game, or there was a Martian. That's kind of an instant connection. Things will be memorable. Certainly for me, because it's kind of the first time I've done this in one of the episodes. So I thank you both. I will have in the show notes your book, Creative Catalyst, the links to both of you. Of course, your book, Yes And. Other ways that people should reach you that you just want to point out here as we end our show?
LinkedIn.
LinkedIn for sure. And otherwise, we'll make sure you have the contact info to get to us so we can help as many people as possible on their improv journey.
And to a better journey. So Cassini Yip, Kevin Weinstein, Creative Catalyst, thank you guys both for joining me, and go out and get a copy of their book. Thanks, guys.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to 97% Effective, where we skip happy talk and help you break through and ascend one hard truth at a time. Help others discover this show. Leave a review and rating wherever you listen to your podcasts. And if you like what you heard, you can get free resources, including the first chapters of Michael's book, Get Promoted, on his website, www.changwinderoth.com. That's www.changwenderoth.com. Shop the Sherwin-Williams 4-Day Super Sale and get 40% off paints and stains June 6th through the 9th. With prices starting at $29.39, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Shop the sale online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.